I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Jennifer Ashley Tepper joins me again. The Broadway producer and historian has just published The Untold Stories of Broadway, Volume 4. In this new book, she takes us into Manhattan's Imperial, Bernard B. Jacobs, Minskoff, Samuel J. Friedman, and Golden Theaters, as well as Studio 54, by revealing their storied histories, the shows they housed, and the performers who trod the boards therein. She also tells us of the so-called Fallen Five, the Morosco, Bijou, the original Helen Hayes, Gaiety, and Astor Theaters, all felled by the wrecking ball in 1982, to be replaced by the Marriott Marquis Hotel and the Marquis Theater within the 49-story complex. What Ms. Tepper has done in these books is reveal what it's like to work and watch in these theaters. She interviews a who's who of Broadway, front of house, backstage, and of course those memorable performers and creators who are recognizable the world over. We see in the book what it takes to make a hit and a flop, and just how magical and sometimes miraculous a theater itself can be for those on and off stage. I'll get Ms. Tepper to tell us about how she views her relationship with the theater, the actual buildings themselves, and the idea of Broadway. Jennifer Ashley Tepper was first on the program in 2019 on the release of the cast album of the Jonathan Larson Project, which she produced. She is the producer of musicals Be More Chill, Broadway Bounty Hunter, and Love in the Hate Nation. She's also creative and programming director at Feinstein's 54 Below. And other than the history she has collected and showcased in this new book and its three previous volumes, not to mention the two forthcoming, she is a historian consultant on the upcoming film version of Tick, Tick, Boom. In 2020, she received the Lincoln Center Emerging Artist Award. Visit her website at jenniferashleytepper.com. This new book is from Dress Circle Publishing. Please welcome back to the Planta Online program, Jennifer Ashley Tepper. Ms. Tepper, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
It's nice to talk to you again. How did this series, The Untold Stories of Broadway, how did it begin?
You know, I've always been super fascinated by not just Broadway history, but the history of the theaters themselves and how the physical stories in the buildings connect us. Because when you're working in a Broadway theater, you're working somewhere that, you know, someone worked 10 years ago, 20 years ago. I always was thinking like, oh, when I'm at the Imperial, Pippin and Dreamgirls have been here, and this is what I'm seeing today. So I really wanted to tell the stories of Broadway folks through the physical spaces themselves.
So theaters have been closed for a while now, but let's say we went to the theater, we went to a show, regardless of which theater it is, and there's a map at the beginning of the book. I'm sure if we sat there just before the overture started or at intermission, you'd probably have a million stories about the theater itself.
Totally. Oh, it's always great fun now for people that go to a show with me, and I'm like, you know that in this spot in 1986, this happened.
For those of us who missed the first three volumes, I mean, for me at least, I'm going to go back and get them because it was just fascinating to read this book. What do you cover in the first three books, say?
You know, so each volume basically has seven current Broadway theaters and one lost Broadway theater that's been demolished or is no longer a Broadway house. So basically the stories in the book are guided by that. You know, there will eventually be six volumes, so I can do all 41 Broadway theaters. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in this volume we have Studio 54 and the Jacobs and the Imperial and the Minskoff, and the lost Broadway theater in this volume is the five Broadway theaters that were demolished in 1982 to build the Marriott Marquis. So basically the stories in each book are guided by the theaters, and I've now done, you know, four sixths of them.
And so how do you group the theaters? Because this book, at least, it seemed to me that they sort of flowed because there were certain themes that say, touched on a lot of these buildings.
Definitely. You know, it's the goal in each volume to have a variety of different Broadway theaters. And folks who go see Broadway shows know, you know, some of the Broadway theaters are older. Some are much smaller. So it's, you know, it's always the goal to have a variety and then to, you know, portray a variety of stories within them. You know, when I was writing about the Golden Theater in this book, I was writing so much about falsettos and the Normal Heart, both of which chronicle, you know, the AIDS pandemic. So you find these little connections in each theater that are really meaningful. You know, there were multiple theaters in this book that shows that were part of the Works Progress Administration and the Federal Theater Project, you know, had productions as part of. So all these little themes kind of tend to emerge, but the goal is to present a variety of theaters in each book.
You mentioned falsettos, and you interviewed William Finn. for this volume. And in reading it, and he talks about a different time, but I mean, people draw parallels to today and COVID. I mean, it has hurt a lot of people this past year. You've lost, I'm sure, the Broadway community has lost a number of people to COVID. When you were writing it, I mean, one couldn't help but say compare today to the crisis of AIDS 35 years ago or so, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, for sure. While very different, there are definitely parallels and interesting things that I thought about as I was, you know, writing about the plays that chronicled the AIDS pandemic. It's also, you know, when you start telling these stories, you realize how many parallels there are. You know, there are so many stories I was able to find and interview people about regarding, like, you know, social justice and, like, racial justice and all of these things of the past year that we've been talking about. Even, you know, I uncovered one story about basically, like, the first big Broadway radio play, and that people at the time had the misconception of, like, oh, it's so exciting, we can hear a Broadway play on the radio, so now no one will go to the theater because they can just hear it in their own homes.
Yeah.
And, of course, what happened with Broadway radio plays was they made people even more excited to both see it in person and listen on the radio. So that just reminded me so much of, like, the conversations around streaming theater. And it's so interesting, as I've written this book during the pandemic mostly, how many things that we've discussed over the last year have been relevant from different eras of theater history.
You've done a marvelous job, Jen, about as a historian in terms of recording Broadway's heritage. But you also realize, you know, the perils of nostalgia, and especially because there's a lot of in the past that's, you know, unpleasant, that's racist, that's sexist. You don't cover that up in the book, do you?
No, you know, that was something that I really thought about a lot with my editor, of how do we shine light on a lot of the problematic elements of theater history and of Broadway, including, you know, things that were very problematic to Black artists, to women. How do we look at what happened and tell the truth about it, rather than going, like, Broadway has always been magical in every way? And that, you know, regarding the LGBTQ community, like, there are things and corners of this that, you know, we forget about because things have gotten better or because things have changed. You know, one of the things that was a great honor about this book was I got to interview the late, great Terrence McNally, who passed away from COVID, actually, and, you know, very devastatingly so. And one of the things that's in this book is his story about his Broadway debut, and which was a show that was very ahead of its time, before people were really widely accepting shows with gay themes. And so there's all kinds of things like that in the book that, you know, we will write a, you know, put a racist review in the book to show how reviews at that time, you know, spoke about artists of color, and then say, you know, this is what actually happened, or, you know, this is why this show wasn't accepted at the time, in order for us all to be better and, like, learn from the past.
What also surprised me about some of the reviews, with, you know, whether it's Brooks Atkinson or Frank Rich, how wrong the critics were at the time.
Yeah, you know, critics are just people with opinions, and it's so funny, but we, you know, take it with a grain of salt sometimes, and then other times it's the gospel. But when you look back and you go, oh, I've always loved this show, I didn't realize it got a bad review, it just makes you realize more and more, you know, a critic's opinion is just, you know, one person's opinion, and it's definitely always interesting to look at the reviews. I think a lot of critics themselves would say, you know, they don't always look back on their own reviews and think, oh, I was totally right, you know. It's an interesting part of theater history and journalism to kind of look back and go, sometimes they were right, sometimes they were wrong.
So when people would ask you as a kid what you wanted to be, you'd say you wanted to be the theater. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, you know, I did. I just always wanted to be part of, like, making new musicals happen and making underappreciated musicals come back to life and theater history. And I had a lot of people I really admired in the industry who kind of forged their own paths and wore unique hats, people like Ted Chapin and Ira Weitzman, who, you know, I was like, I'm not going to end up doing exactly what either of those people do, but I can kind of make my own path, and I've been lucky enough to kind of be the theater in my own way. Certainly over the past year writing this book without theater, I have felt like I have a little flame burning in my apartment as I'm telling the story, so it's felt closer to home recently.
Yeah, reading the book especially, I mean, I could just imagine what writing this was like during a pandemic. It makes you just awfully nostalgic, doesn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. And so many of the stories, I think, while being some are relevant and some, as I said, like touch on themes we've been talking about, but so many are just about like the importance of like community and how Broadway is like a neighborhood and how important all these pieces of art have been to audience members and artists. And so just like keeping it alive during a time when we're on pause has felt really meaningful.
So on the cover of the book are a bunch of names. What we would call the bold-faced names, if you will, you know, the names above the title, people that we would recognize. And so I opened the book looking forward to reading these stories from them. But after I finished the book, the ones that I found most profound, the ones that lingered in my head, were the stories of say, the stagehand or the makeup mm-hmm. artist or the person who works the front of the house. And one realizes just how important all those parts are to a show.
Absolutely. You know, some of my favorite interviews in this book are from those people who don't get interviewed as often. There's like an incredible interview with Angelina Avalon, the makeup designer, about her work on Dance of the Vampires. And there's such an incredible interview from two of the stagehands that worked at the Jacobs and have for years, Mike Van Prague and Fred Ricci, who, you know, have basically lived in that theater for decades. So there are, I've been very lucky to interview people like that. I also, as I was writing this volume, I was like, oh, this volume has a lot of stories about specifically subbing as a musician. So it's like being able to pull back on the curtain on certain elements of people who don't get interviewed as often and really like reveal to people who are fans of Broadway what those jobs are like is such an important part of these books to me.
Yeah, and you get a sense, too, of the celebrities, of the stars themselves, what they really are like backstage, which I thought, you know, adds a great flavor to, you know, the theater and why we like it so much.
Totally. It's always really exciting to read stories and to hear stories from folks who worked in the theater who are like, oh, yeah, and, you know, then Julia Roberts used to sit in this chair you're sitting in, and she was so kind. You know, there's a lot of stuff like that, and I've also just been lucky to interview, you know, there's a great story from, like, Jason Alexander in this book about how he was obsessed with Pippin as a kid, and then he saw Fiddler on the Roof at the same theater, the Imperial, as a kid, and then he returned to that theater as a star to do Jerome Robbins Broadway and won a Tony for, like, portraying Tevye in part of that show. And during quarantine, I've actually been watching all of Seinfeld. So for me, I've been like, oh, Jason Alexander is in this book. It's very surreal to kind of have those interviews.
Yeah, and that's what makes the book special is that these are not just buildings, obviously. They're shrines. There's something spiritual when you walk through them as you sit there. You tell a marvelous story about your own experience about when you first got to New York as a kid, sitting in front of the Neil Simon Theater. Is that right?
Yeah, definitely. And
just sitting there, you know, there's a special moment there, isn't there, when you do that?
Totally. I feel like very spiritually connected to the theaters themselves. And in fact, you know, during quarantine, when all of Times Square has been very different than it's ever been during my lifetime and very much a ghost town, I've been having similar experiences. Like when I first moved to New York and would just stand in front of the theaters, it felt weirdly connected. You know, the Fallen Five are in this book, which is, you know, the five theaters that were demolished to build the Marquee. Yeah. And I've definitely spent some time walking around that block of 45th and 46th Street, kind of just going, oh, there's no mark that these theaters were here. There's no physical evidence. And yet I'm trying to, like, bring them to life. So when I needed to take a break and had maybe a little bit of writer's block, I would walk around that block and go, I have to tell the stories of these invisible theaters that are right here, which it really did feel similar to when I would go and stand in front of the theaters when I first moved here.
Yeah. What, because, you know, it is awful to lose a building, and you tell the story in the book about, you know, what people did in 1982 to try to save those theaters. At the same time, you know, there are stories in the book about what awful places they were to work in, one of them in particular, I guess, right?
Yeah, you know, that is such a funny part of this. I really tried to present all sides of this, and it's you know, I think with any theater, as I've learned as I've been doing these interviews, there's pros and cons to working in all of them. Some people are like, oh my God, I love this theater. It's so beautiful and old and has such history. And also, like, because of that, it's one of the most cramped back stages. Or, oh, you know, this theater is newer and it doesn't quite have the lore and it's more of an auditorium. But we have so much space and there's all these technological things we can do here. So each kind of has the good and bad. But I have to say that Bijou, which was the really underappreciated theater that was one of the ones that was demolished, you know, as much as some people were like, oh, this theater was like, you know, had all this trash everywhere and was not as nicely kept up. If we had that theater today, I think it would be like an incredible smaller Broadway house that would be an alternative space for shows. And so it just goes to show you, like, things can kind of turn around and you don't know what to expect. But one of the main takeaways really from those stories was, like, you have to start the protests earlier. Like, when something like this is going to happen, you have to kind of raise your voice as soon as you know about it. Although that said, you know, the other big takeaway was that one of the main things we got out of those theaters being demolished was that all of the other Broadway theaters are really landmarks kind of because of it. So luckily in this time where things are a little bit unsure of how Broadway will come back and how long it will take, luckily the theaters are not in danger in the way they might have been had this not happened and they hadn't been landmarked at that time.
And that's the thing, as I was reading the book, it seems like all these, especially the older ones, I mean, they're all saved now. And nothing like 1982 will happen again, right?
You know, I hope not. I certainly will be the first person to handcuff myself to the wrecking ball, God forbid it does. But,
yeah.
But no, I don't think it will. There's a certain, like, understanding of the longevity of the theaters. I do think there's a possibility of, like, you know, alternative programming in the coming years as we get back on our feet and, you know, let's put a concert into this house because it's empty right now and we don't have a show. And so, you know, and that's happened enough in recent years anyway. But I do think the theaters are safe, and it's largely because after those theaters were demolished, there was such an uproar. So we can be grateful that they had a legacy that was positive in that way.
What about building a new one? Is that a possibility, say?
You know, it's always a possibility, certainly a dream. There were plans reported that a new Broadway theater was being built on, like, 8th Avenue and 45th Street, which then supposedly, like, kind of didn't happen and is not happening now, but you never know. I think also, you know, a lot of people's dream is for the Mark Hellinger, which is now home of the Times Square Church, to return to its Broadway theater status. And so that was the lost theater in my first book. And you never know, you know, the church is there right now, but that theater still looks like it did when My Fair Lady played there. So someday that could happen. We Broadway people, as I've noted numerous times over the last year, we do not give up hope.
Yeah, and so, you know, you obviously are optimistic about the future of Broadway. What will it look like, I guess? I mean, a year from now, if we talk, what do you think, will it be back in business, say?
Definitely. You know, I think that ahead of us is, like, a long road of a lot of challenges for people that work in theater, but I do think it's, like, it's going to be an incredibly exciting time to, like, you know, gradually rebuild the industry and imagine, you know, what things can be. And, you know, I think that the key to this is, like, it's not all going to come back right away. It's going to take time for Broadway to build back to what it was. But we've never had a reset like this. There's never been a shutdown this long. So I think it's going to be the beginning of our own roaring 20s, and there will be a lot of really exciting theater that comes from this. I don't know that it'll come, you know, in the first 6 months of when we start back up, but I think it'll take a little time, but there are definitely good things ahead.
And you know, if you're a kid in Florida today and you're interested in this stuff and you want to be in the theater, be the theater like, you know, like you wanted to be as a kid, there's never been a better opportunity to see this stuff. I mean, you can hear it on your phone right away on, you know, on Spotify or iTunes or YouTube and you know, all the streaming things that we've had in the last year, those opportunities. I mean, you regardless of where you are in your country or mine even, it's accessible, isn't it?
Absolutely. And, like, you know, kids growing up all over the country, all over the world, have never had more, you know, access via the internet to theater masterclasses and to, as you said, like, stream performances and all kinds of things like that. As many, you know, terrible things as there have been about the past year, including the shutdown, there's also positives as far as, like, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think, you know, the next era is going to have so many opportunities for people to, you know, create their own scrappy theater company in the parking lot. You know, it's a lot of, like, how can you make your own stuff? And as we know from theater history, it's, like, the things that end up blowing up and, like, changing the world almost always do start small, of, like, hey, it was a pandemic, so we had to do a show in a mask in a parking lot, and then it, you know, went to off-Broadway. There's all kinds of scenarios where the next era rewards people who kind of are innovative, and I think young people and, you know, even people of all ages all over the country who want to be the theater have that going for them right now of, like, we don't know what's next, so, like, let's invent it ourselves.
We've talked before about working at Studio 54, and you cover that theater in this book. It's got a long history, even before the nightclub. I'm an agnostic about ghosts. When you work there, I mean, have you encountered sort of these feelings or spirits, if you will?
You know, I don't think I have. I don't quite completely believe in ghosts, although I have to say after hearing some extraordinary ghost stories from my books, I've been swayed a little bit.
Yeah.
The thing about Studio 54, though, is, like, even if it's not literal ghosts, you can really feel that, like, the theater looks as it did in the disco heyday. It looks as it did in the early 20s when it was, you know, first opening. There's a lot of, like, you know, you walk through the gorgeous marble hallway that leads to the theater, and you know that it looks just like that when, you know, Liza Minnelli and, you know, Andy Warhol were walking into Studio 54. So there's a certain, like, historic energy that feels maybe a little ghostly, but I haven't seen any literal ghosts.
Yeah, something that comes up a lot in the book is the safe. And I guess, you know, that's the infamous safe that Steve Rubell kept cash and drugs. I guess it's so big that they can't get it out of there, right?
Yes, that was just, like, one of my favorite things that I saw with my own eyes. I loved that when I saw people in the picture at that theater, the kids had the dressing room with the safe and were keeping candy in there where Steve Rubell would keep his money and drugs. But also, you know, there's such a fascinating, obviously so much lore about it, disco heyday. But also, you know, like, Studio 54 was once a TV studio where episodes of Password and Whose Line Is It Anyway and Captain Kangaroo filmed. So there's, like, endless crazy stories about that. And, you know, Studio 54, because it opened initially as a Broadway theater and then became all these other things, it didn't actually have a hit show for 71 years until the Cabaret revival in the 90s. So the fact that we have this, like, Broadway theater that persevered for that long and wasn't demolished and wasn't destroyed, even though it took that long, is that was really inspiring to me.
Yeah, these are shows that people have never heard of, right?
Yeah. You know, it definitely opened in its early years. It had a lot of shows that were not hits or were remain obscure for whatever reason. One that I was really fascinated was this show called Medicine Show, which was basically a takedown of, like, public health folly within the government. And it was a really interesting thing to kind of look at that as parallel to this time of, like, how doctors treat patients and, like, oh, this was a show that ran for a very short period of time and is forgotten but seems so relevant. But, yeah, no, they didn't have any, you know, big hit show until the comeback in the 90s with Cabaret.
Yeah. The other thing that struck me as I was reading the book, because whether you're talking to artists or artisans, someone would wonder why one would go into the theater, because, I mean, you know, for all the good things that happen in a career in the theater, I mean, it's a lot of hard work. It's a lot of bad, you know, times as well. You know, I'm sure people ask you all the time why people do this.
Totally. No, it is a hard life, but I think nothing reminded me more of, like, why it's the best life than writing this book and looking at these stories again, because it's so rewarding. It's so extraordinary. There's absolutely nothing like people in a room with each other telling stories, which for a year we haven't been able to do.
Yeah.
And as wonderful and, like, incredible as all of the virtual stuff is and, you know, how grateful we all are to have movies and TV during this time, you know, there's nothing that can replace live theater and how special it is to communicate with people in a room. So I think that, if anything, this last year has made it even more clear how essential it is.
And I referred to this map that's at the beginning of the book. You've been to all these theaters, have you?
I have. I mean, certainly I haven't been to the demolished,
right,
fallen,
right,
time.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
But I'm sure you could also play out in your head what those five were like, right?
And every time I hear a little, like, detail about them, I'm like, oh, yeah, this theater had an alley that went here. I, like, you know, I build the map in my head.
Yeah. I was watching the Sunshine Boys on TCM a few weeks ago, and they would refer to the Morosco Theater. And so it was fun reading your book and thinking about that and, you know, what vaudeville was like, and
oh, cool.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's just,
I'll have to rewatch that.
Yeah. The response to these books has just been tremendous. It's a lot of work. When you look back at it all, I mean, you're still in the midst of it, but when you look back at, say, these four volumes now, I mean, it's invaluable, isn't it, to readers, but to yourself, I mean, as a producer and the sort, it must be going to school even, right?
Yeah, thank you for saying that. You know, definitely, and it's taken a different meaning as I've been writing it, obviously, over the last year, but because I started in 2013 and the majority of the interviews, you know, happened in 2013, although I've certainly done many since, it's not only a time capsule now of, oh, I interviewed this person about a story in 1960 and now we're talking about the 60s. It's also like I interviewed them about the 1960s in 2013 and now things are different in multiple ways with them and with that story in 2021. So it's definitely driven home the point for me of like what an amazing time capsule these are of, you know, Broadway history.
How would you go about your conversations with these folks? I mean, do you have a certain amount of time? Where do you do them even? I mean, you allude to in the book about doing them in a diner. Would they be on the phone even, say?
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you asked that because it's something I've definitely been thinking about. Like, the New York City of this book is definitely imbued in the interviews as well.
Yeah.
Typically, I spend about, like, an hour to an hour and a half with each person, like, on average. And really, the interviews were conducted all over New York, like, everywhere from, you know, Riverside Park to, like, downtown in, you know, a diner. They were conducted in, like, dozens and dozens and dozens of different places, many in people's apartments, many backstage at theaters that people were working in at the time. And I think, truly, that energy is part of the interviews. I also, you know, my best thing that I learned to do after a little while was, like, do all the research, remind yourself of, like, what shows these people did in what year at what theater and, you know, what are they asked about in the interviews all the time and what aren't they asked about, and then forget all about it and don't bring a cheat sheet. This is just my own personal journey.
Yeah.
And, like, just kind of put it out of your mind and talk to the person. For me, that's I found that to be the best protocol.
I mean, you can read in some of the interviews just how, you know, exciting it must have been like to hear them say something that you probably didn't expect them to say.
Absolutely. There's so much of that. And there are even some tiny moments in the book where I've, like, left in something that someone said specifically to me.
Yeah.
I'll never forget when I was interviewing George C. Wolfe, who's one of my heroes, in his apartment. And at the end of the interview, he was talking about working with Nora Ephron, who, you know, I also really admired.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, and you're sitting in Nora's chair, because, you know, that was the chair
wow.
that he specifically sat in when they would meet. So things like that, you know, which wouldn't end up in maybe a Broadway history book if it was, like, a, you know, research fully just, like, research volume, I kept in, like, those conversational elements.
Yeah. You've talked to a lot of people. I mean, there's a page in the back here with dozens and dozens of names for this volume. Are there people that you would have liked to talk to, say, and I guess we'll keep it to those that are still living, that you haven't talked to yet?
Definitely. You know, because it goes by theater, there are certainly people that I'm like, oh, I haven't done the La Fontaine yet, so I definitely want to talk to these La Fontaine, you know, people. There are also, you know, certainly people I haven't gotten to interview that I would have loved to. It's always just like, how do we tell the fullest story about each theater possible? And so, you know, do we have a director from this decade? And do we have a musician from this house? And so, yeah, it's really a puzzle. But I will say, like, there's also people who are in the books who aren't in this volume because obviously they didn't work in these
yeah.
theaters. So it's always a really fun puzzle.
Yeah. Do you have a wish list? I mean, I hate to ask that because I have, you know, I have my own list and I hate it when people ask me. But I'll ask you anyway. Are there people at the top of your list that you really want?
Great question. You know, I've been so focused on this book that I haven't really done my wish list for the, like, final two volumes. I will say when I started thinking about the La Fontaine, and I also haven't done the Music Box yet, I was like, oh, I have to talk to Adrienne Warren about her experiences on Tina and Shuffle Along. So she's definitely someone I hope to get in a future volume. But, yeah, you know, I always really, really wanted to interview Mary Rodgers, and I sadly didn't get to do that before she passed. And she's someone where when I do have someone like that or otherwise who I'm like, oh, I wish I got to interview this person, I try to include their stories in the book through my own writing that's in between each interview and, you know, my own essays about what happened in the theaters. A lot of kind of making sure that a lot of people are represented is, you know, me telling the stories myself if I didn't get to interview them.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing that's really terrific as I'm reading the book is seeing just how much fun you're having doing it. How do you do it, especially when you know you are busy otherwise? You know, I mean, you're producing shows and you're programming at 54 Below. How did you find the time to do it when you were working, say?
You know, a lot of those interviews were done for the first book, which was in 2013. I would say I've probably done about 300 interviews now, and I think about 200 were just done in 2013, which was a very busy year. It was actually the year I started programming 54 Below, and a really, you know, busy time. And I had these days where I would be like, okay, it's Saturday. Today you're interviewing William Ivy Long at 10 a.m., Danny Burstein at noon, Misan Peacock at 2 p.m., and all over the city in different places, like spaced by 2 hours. And those were like extraordinary days where I actually felt like I was like a peak interviewer, like at the top of my powers, because like my brain was just like so in it. And since then, a lot of the interviews have been more scattered and also like focused in different ways. But that year was a big thing. And, you know, I didn't sleep that much. It was okay. I'm glad about it. It was really a busy time and an extraordinary time.
So what is it like now for you when you produce shows of your own? Do you keep a journal, say? Do you talk to people, say, take notes and keep a memory book, if you will, of your work now?
Definitely. You know, I've kept track of all of it in different ways. I think that being a producer and, you know, certainly the last few years of working on Broadway have informed these books a great deal. And there have definitely been stories I wanted to tell when I was writing this volume that might not have been on my mind if I hadn't, you know, just spent a year on a Broadway show. So, I've kept some records of those things, and I think they've also just helped inform my writing.
Now, 54 Below, has it been shut down since last March, or have you been able to come back at all briefly?
Just like everyone in live performance in New York, we've been shut down since March, but we're feeling very hopeful about the future and, you know, coming back. Really an exciting time is going to be had by all when it's able to happen.
Congratulate you on this volume and wish you the best on future volumes, because it's just a fun and engaging read, and I can't wait to go back to the previous ones. I appreciate your time today. Thanks for this.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for being so kind to the book. I really appreciate it.
Visit JenniferAshleyTepper.com for more information. The book is called The Untold Stories of Broadway, Volume 4. It's from Dress Circle Publishing. Jen Tepper joined me on the line from New York City and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.